Yeah, we had a little break, and we've just been looking back at the interview that you did in, I think it was 95, where you felt that you had covered it pretty well. As I understand, there were three things you had to do. One was change personnel, one was change the plant, one was change the mine. That's pretty much everything. Yeah,
that was pretty much everything. And,
and you were only there 3 years, but you managed to do those.
Well,
and
we really did have a good crew of people, a great crew of people, both in the mine and in the plant, to make those changes.
And you also had to change the contracts.
And we had to change the contracts. So we had, first of all, convince the Japanese why they should stay with us, and then with their concurrence, go ahead and make these changes.
Now, did they have that much choice? Could they have just canceled and walked away from it?
Yes, they could have, except unfortunately for us, the Japanese had this master plan that they didn't want to be dependent on any one country for their raw materials, because mm-hmm. that would then put them at a disadvantage perhaps some future time. So they tried to have a good diversity of feedstock sources so that no one country could sort of hold them up and prevent them from mixing their materials in a way that was most beneficial to them. So, because of this country philosophy on getting materials for manufacturing, they felt that British Columbia was important to them, and this was the first project out of the box for them. So that was the only game in town in British Columbia at that time.
So you had a little bit of leverage.
So there was leverage there, and plus Kaiser had really established a very good reputation with the Japanese because of the pelletizing plant down at Eagle Mountain and other things that the Kaiser people, Jack Ashby, Jack Carlson, Lee Emerson, all did with the Japanese. They became personal friends with the Mitsubishi Trading Company people. So there was that excellent relationship that was just critical in getting the Japanese to agree to work with the company to work these things out rather than dumping the whole thing.
Were they getting coal from Australia as well?
Yes, and of course that coal was coming right on schedule. No, it was from Utah.
Right.
And it was
iron from Kaiser.
Well, iron from the Kaiser Consortium. They were part of the Hammersley. They with RTZ with. They were in partnership with them, but
Mount Tom Price
was the first of the iron ore mines, but on the coal side,
Utah
coal was perhaps even a little bit superior metallurgically to the coal we had in Canada, but much easier to recover, and the Utah guys just had a whiz-bang of a project, did a great job with it. We're always delivering on time, on spec, making money, and no whining like we were. We envied them greatly for having done such a good job. We heard a lot about it from the Japanese, how good they were doing. And no fussing, no whining, good quality, all of that. And of course we had it coming because we weren't doing any of those things. But that was the circumstance. There are a couple of things that I noticed in the first interview. One of the things that I want to correct is that when we finally got everything going, got the plant modified, got the stripping done for good quality coal, and started producing coal. Got the plant up to its rated production rate, and we're making specification coal and shipping it to the port in Vancouver. the situation occurred, and I mentioned this in the earlier interview, and I was incorrect. The situation occurred that when Kaiser Resources was first established as a public company in Canada, at the beginning of the project, the prospectus and all of the accompanying documents for the public offering neglected to say that members of Kaiser Steel, senior executives in Kaiser Steel, were awarded stock options on Kaiser Resources stock that was being issued in Canada. I incorrectly said in that first interview that they were awarded stock, and that is not the case. They were awarded stock options, which later, after the stock price went up, some of the executives did exercise their options and sell the stock, which caused quite a scandal because none of the offering documents had said that they were awarded these options in the first place. And so that was a great embarrassment to the company, and particularly to Edgar Kaiser Sr., who never, to my knowledge, anyone's knowledge, ever did anything that was inappropriate, and certainly not anything that was illegal or not straightforward. So it was a great embarrassment to him personally that this could have happened. And so I described this, that he sent up one of his very trusted confidants and business associates, Steve Girard, to run the Canadian company as president, and also sent his son Edgar Jr. up as an executive vice president to be over the mining operation. And all of that is covered in the other one. But I just wanted to correct that one thing that I said incorrectly, that they were given stock options, not stock outright.
We should just give a quick recap for the benefit of anybody who might not have that other interview available, that you were able to do all these.
Yeah, we did get everything running. took about a year and a half to get all of the things completed. And during that year and a half, we did ship steam coal to Japan, and so all of that took place. And like I said, it took about 18 months to get it all completed. But in the other interview, I described that we had just gotten the plant modifications made and got up to full production, and the dryer plant, the second of the two buildings in the plant site, caught fire, and so that was a great setback. Mm-hmm. But the fortunate thing about the timing of the fire, because obviously the fire wasn't fortunate, but the timing was in that the engineers, Kaiser engineers that had done the modifications for the plant, had just left. But all of the drawings, everything, all of the fabricators that we used for the plant modification, that was all still in place. That we knew all of the people that had done this. Mm-hmm. And within 8 or 10 hours, we had contacted everybody and alerted them as to what happened. They got up there, quickly determined what parts of the structure need to be changed and who had built it in the first place. And within 3.5 weeks, we had the plant running again, even after that fire. And the reason it could have been done so fast, we had everybody was there that had done it before. So they knew exactly where the sources for the replacements were, and quickly mobilize all that. So that was a remarkable thing.
I had a couple of little questions. I referred to in the other interview, the heading on this section was the Balmer mine. Now, is this the way you referred to it? What?
Well, it was the Balmer coal seam, and I guess we did call it the open pit was the Balmer mine.
That's correct. I've forgotten
the Balmer project.
What was is that the general way it was referred to?
Yes, I think so, because it was the Balmer coal seam that was being mined. It's 50 foot thick coal seam.
When you talk about that era, you
did call it that
as Balmer. Is that
the Balmer mine? Yeah.
And you didn't mention anything about your family, but this meant moving them up there from the desert to the snow.
That's right. Yeah, my kids had been born and raised in the desert. First Tucson, or the Tucson area, southern Arizona, and then Eagle Mountain. So they had never really been around snow, and they great time for them to move up there. It just so happens that the manager that took my place at Eagle Mountain had just come down to us from Kennecott. His name was Kay Olson.
In Utah.
From Utah, in Bingham Canyon, Salt Lake. And so Kay had two boys, and as they were unloading there, they lived right next door to us, moved in right next door to us, and as they were unloading the van, my boys saw these skis and these ski boots and all this stuff, which they had never seen before. And they were just delighted to learn all about skiing and stuff. And it wasn't less than a year later, that we moved to Canada and the boys got to have all of their own ski stuff and ski. So they had a great time. This was that period where there wasn't all that much love and joy to have Americans around in this small little mining town, particularly after what had happened, and then the satisfaction of seeing that the Americans weren't as good as they thought they were, and the project was not doing well.
You had said in the other interview that there is a lot of anti-American sentiment,
and understandably, one
of the things that you turned around.
Well, I really was conscious of it, and so recognized that we needed all of the Canadian support we could get, not only employees, but from the government and everyone else. But speaking of the family, it was difficult for Phyllis at first because, you know, people didn't want to extend themselves too much. And so she was sort of having to rattle around in this little town on her own for a while, because the people that had been there that we knew had gone. I let them go. And so she really didn't have any friends when we went up there. And so it took about 6 months before some of the gals started to warm up. And you know, within another 6 months, it was as if we'd been there forever. So that worked out good. The boys were in school. And I forget, my oldest son must have just been starting high school.
Where was the high school?
It was in Fernie. We lived in Fernie. So he was starting in high school, and Press must have been about the sixth or seventh grade, probably. It was during that time, the transfer of schools, Red was able to make that transfer academically. The Canadian schools, much better than the Southern California schools. Red was able to make that transfer satisfactorily. Press, the younger son, had difficulty with it. And so after half a year or so, or maybe that it was the next year, we enrolled Press in a private school over on Vancouver Island, Shawnigan Lake. And so he went to school over there. Red continued in the school system there at Fernie. And as sort of a mark of achievement for him, he was elected student body president his last year there, his senior year at in Fernie. Mm-hmm. And that was the year that I left Kaiser and Fernie, left in January, and joined Consolidation Coal Company. Red stayed on with some friends of ours, the Papanos, to finish out his senior year there. And Phyllis commuted back and forth from the United States to Fernie on a pretty frequent basis during that last 3 or 4 months until Red graduated from college or high school. Mm-hmm. And Press was at, still at Shawnigan Lake, so that didn't affect him when we moved.
Mm. How do you spell Shawnigan?
Oh gee, Shaw. Shawnigan. Okay. I guess I.
That's what I guessed.
Yeah.
Nigan.
Yeah,
I
think so.
Like
okay. I think so.
All right. And your friends were named the.
Papanos. P-O-P. Papen. P-E-N-O-E. P-O-P-E-N-O-E.
I was making it Greek, but it's Cornish, I'll bet.
I think so. I think you're right.
Yeah, that looks Cornish now. I had it Greek. Okay. More likely Cornish, you know,
yeah.
Canadian man.
Yeah, I suspect. Mm-hmm. The Greek. He didn't look Greek.
No, probably Cornish. Okay. Some of those.
So anyhow, we really did enjoy the people there in Fernie. They became good friends of ours. Mm-hmm.
What sorts of social life did you have?
Well,
what did Phyllis do?
That little town had a great social life. You know, mostly in the homes, and then for especially, you know, like New Year's Eve and those kinds of events, there'd be a hall somewhere in town where everybody would go and have drinks and dance.
What was the population of the town?
There was about 5,000 or 6,000 people, I would guess, and it had its own little communities. There was an Italian section, there was a Greek section, there was a Welsh section. Mm-hmm. And they all lived in their own little part of town, and they all knew each other, but they all each lived in their own section.
Did what sort of how many employees did you have?
Well, we must have had we had virtually all the employees in the valley.
I see. So it
there was,
was
another company, but it was much smaller.
It was not really a company town, though. Or,
well,
or how would you characterize?
No, it was a public town. Oh. It was like Grant.
Okay.
It was like Grant. Mm-hmm. In that there were several other companies, but most of the other companies were contractors to us, one way or another. A guy that ran the bus service was a contractor to us. A guy that had a fleet of highway haulage trucks to haul coal for us from different places that were being mined. These are all highway type trucks, not our off highway pit trucks, and then mechanical contractors to us. So most everybody, one way or another, worked for us. But our direct employees probably numbered no more than 1,500.
Did you have company houses?
No. Now, I said no. We up at Sparwood, which is where the plant and the mine were. We started a community there, and we paid for the development of the lots and the infrastructure, and then made it possible for people to buy the homes, but by guaranteeing the mortgage and, in many cases, giving a second mortgage, a very low interest rate. In other words, subsidized them into these houses, but it wasn't a company town like we knew company towns, mm-hmm. where the company owned and operated the houses.
You owned your own home in Fernie?
No, my predecessor had a home there that he didn't own either. The company owned it, but he paid rent on it. Mm-hmm. And so we took that home when he left. It's a nice big house right on the river, old-fashioned house. But
what was it like?
Well, it was two-story, largest home we'd ever been in our lives. It was quite grand from that, but it was expensive to maintain, to heat it. Yeah, it was awful. So it came at a price.
No, you say on the river, so it's down. You're down in the valley then.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Fernie's in the valley.
Okay.
And several rivers run together right at Fernie. One's a smaller stream, and then the Elk River is the bigger river. Elk.
Mm-hmm.
That comes from the north, and it joins another smaller stream right there at Fernie. But we were right on the confluence of that smaller stream, and
sounds pretty.
Yeah. Oh, it was a beautiful. Beautiful spot. Fernie's a lovely little town. I'm sure it's changed. I was just talking on the phone over the holidays with one of our friends there. She and her husband were dear friends of Phyllis and mine, and he has died. But she had sent us a letter, but she had had a stroke and couldn't read the letter, so I called her up so I could talk to her and find out how everybody was, but it's just a beautiful spot.
Let's talk a little bit about the health care, the social life, and some of those things. You had a hospital there, did you?
Had a hospital there. A big dilemma for us. Red had never had his tonsils, our oldest son had never had his tonsils out, and here he was, a senior in high school or a junior, and you know, when you get to be an adult, having your tonsils out is not to be taken lightly. And we were really concerned, should we have him operated on here, or should we take him down to the States and have him operated on? Finally, we decided, well, no, we're up here, we're part of this community. That wouldn't be good to take him down.
But those are heavy decisions.
Heavy decisions, right. And Red was part of it. He agreed with that. So anyhow, we had it done there at the hospital in Fernie, and there was a large hospital, well, you know, for a 5,000 person community. In fact, it was for a lot of the communities around. It was the only one within 20 or 30 miles, so it serviced a bigger area than that. But had it done by a doc that took care of all of us. Canada has this social medicine system, and they really have, we certainly had there in Fernie. I think there were two or three doctors, but this one old guy was our doctor, tough old, thin, hard guy, a hiker and a skier and all that stuff. He did the surgery on Red and did a great job, and Red just came through it with fine colors, and so that all worked out great. But talking about this doctor, this anti-American stuff, I hadn't been there too long, and gosh, I had these darn pains in my stomach. And so
I don't doubt it.
I look back on it, I know why I had those pains in my stomach. But anyhow, I'd never had pains in my stomach before. So after a week or so of this, I called him up one day and said, look, I'm coming, and the mine was 20 miles up the road. So I said, I'm going to come in early if you can see me this afternoon. And he said, yeah, come on in. So I did. And in due course, he could see me. So he said, what's wrong with you? And I said, oh, my stomach, it's been aching for a week and I can't understand it. I've never had this before. He said, well, I'll lay down on the table there. So I laid down on the table and he starts poking me. He said, my God, you Americans are soft. He was poking me in the stomach. And I thought, you son of a gun, what do you mean? And so I went home and I told Phyllis that. And she said, well, you know, you are putting on a little weight. And boy, I tell you, that just changed me. I thought, by golly, nobody's ever going to tell me that again. So it was his remark was wonderful. Just what I needed to hear. Anyhow, we always had good.
What were the stomach pains from?
I just think it was nerves.
Stress,
yeah,
probably.
Yeah,
you must have been under terrible stress.
Yeah, I was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I enjoyed it all. Mm-hmm. But it manifested itself that way. Yeah, my stomach didn't enjoy
it.
Did
you have headaches or sleep problems?
No, I slept good. Just that darn stomach aches. But it went away. And I think probably as much because of what he told me as anything, because I don't remember taking anything for him.
Did you start exercising or anything of that?
Well, no, I didn't then. I didn't really. I was working long
you
hours.
You were doing walking around, probably.
Well, I was always walking around the plant and the mines and stuff, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I got exercise that way, but I didn't have any regimen for exercise. I did start playing badminton with one of the people there. But because of my long hours, I just didn't take time. Shouldn't have taken time as I think about it, because I've done that later in life. But didn't have any regimen that I should have had.
What about the social life? Did they play what, bridge, poker, pinochle?
Well, Phyllis and I never did that. We didn't play cards with people. We never got into one of those groups. And I'm sure they did there. I'm sure the ladies did. But Phyllis didn't do that. She spent a lot of time with the boys because I was gone, you know, not away from home, except when I went to Oakland or to Japan. But I was up at the mine, you know, go up early in the morning and come back late at night, and pretty much 7 days a week for a couple of years. So she spent a lot of time with the boys when they were in school, particularly at first when the boys didn't have a lot of friends either. So the social life really was couples. We'd have either dinners at our house or at their house, or so that'd be some kind of function that we'd all go to that either involved something that was happening at school or some holiday or something.
Was there anything like a Rotary Club?
If there was, I'm not aware of it.
You were not in it.
I was not in it, no.
You were just working.
No service clubs. And I really don't know. I don't remember seeing any signs going in and out of town like they usually have, Rotary and Kiwanis and all that. I don't remember ever seeing that.
It wasn't part of your life anyway.
Yeah, it wasn't
church,
not part of my
there
life.
Churches?
There was an Episcopal church there, and we went to that. Not all the time, but on occasion. And obviously a Catholic church that was the largest denomination in town. And probably another church or two. So there was as many churches as there were bars. And of course in Canada you have to have an eating establishment to have a bar. And you have to have accommodations, so they were always hotels. The bars were always in hotels.
What about drinking?
There was not a great deal of drinking. When we'd go out, we'd all have drinks, but I don't remember it being a social problem.
Sometimes those isolated, cold places get pretty heavy drinking.
No, I don't recall that that being a problem. Now, our wives would probably have a little different answer to that question about drinking than we would. But
why?
Well, because guys always drink too much. But, from a standpoint of different problems in the community or work.
I was thinking of your personal social life.
Yeah. We would all drink, I would say moderately, social drinking. We learned quickly that when you go to a party someplace in the winter, you don't want to be the last one to leave because you got the galoshes that were left. And you'd go in a brand new pair of galoshes and you'd go home with the two worst looking galoshes, usually for the same foot. So you wanted to leave early to get your galoshes. That was one of the things I remember. You don't want to stay at a party too long.
Could you buy most of your supplies, your personal domestic supplies, food and things there, or did folks have to go someplace
shop? No, it was too far to go any place to shop. No, it was the biggest town. So, we bought everything there. The only place we'd ever lived where they didn't deliver milk to your house, but they'd deliver beer.
Oh.
Yeah, there was a local brewery, and they would deliver beer to your house. But Phyllis couldn't get milk delivered to the house. It used to make her so mad.
What did you drink when you went to parties?
Usually beer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those days usually beer.
Mm.
And most, just about everybody did. Perhaps vodka was a drink that was popular. I think more with the women than the guys. But those are the two things I recall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but mostly beer.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow,
you had wanted to mention also the hydraulic mining, and you did discuss that in the other interview.
Yeah, and I've reviewed that, and mm-hmm. I think that's pretty complete.
This is one innovation.
It was something that was so successful there because of the type of formation that the coal occurred in, very steeply dipping coal seams that could not be mined conventionally by room and pillar. Because they dipped so steeply, you couldn't mine them open pit because of the overburden ratio. And here were these beautiful coal measures that seemed to be unrecoverable and just ideally suited to this system of hydraulic mining that would, with high pressure water, you'd just knock the coal down out of the face and just sluice it down a drift or a passageway that you had driven up to the top part of the coal seam on about a 7-degree angle and dug a ditch along the side of the entryway that the water would just sluice the coal right down the ditch and right out of the mine and right into a settling tank to take the water out of it, and it's ready to go,
mm-hmm.
right to the plant. And it was tremendously successful.
But has not been copied very much.
No, and it takes a unique situation as far as the coal deposition is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But there must be other places where it could have been used. As I mentioned in the other interview, we went over to the mine in Japan that had been successfully doing this, and it was a very, very narrow vein that they were working in, and they were making it work quite well. So I know in the Rockies there have got to be other circumstances where that could work, and perhaps it is now. I haven't been in the coal business for a long time, so I'm probably not current on that, but That was a very successful operation. Very cheap way to mine coal. So that was another thing that we had done there that was sort of.
Okay, so you were only there 3 years. You did an awful lot in that time.
And I really had intended to go up for just 3 years when I had decided to go.
Why?
Because I felt that working outside of the country, you might have good advancement opportunities outside the country. If you ever wanted to come back, you would sort of have to go back in the queue and sort of work back up again. And so I didn't want to do that. And so I had made that conscious decision not to go for it, but then when I decided to take this job up there, I thought, well, I'll just do that for 3 years and come back. But getting back to, you mentioned Edgar Kaiser Jr., I think I mentioned in the other interview that while I had hoped and been led to believe that I might be the president of that Canadian company, it turns out that I was not to be that, but I will say again that everything was running well when I left, everything had been done that needed to be done. The operation was now performing very satisfactorily. The next phase was to get the Japanese to pay for the added costs of all the things that had to be done from the first contract to what it was costing now to produce the coal. And so it took somebody of the stature of Steve Girard, who went up as president, and Edgar Jr., who was the son of Edgar Sr., who had this good relationship with the Japanese going back many years. It took people of that stripe to be able to negotiate with the Japanese contracts that would be profitable for Kaiser. And I could not have done that. I could not have carried the same weight to that they did. So while that was a disappointment to me, from the company standpoint, I can't fault that at all. So at any rate, I can't remember, I think I described how I came to leave Kaiser.
Well, very briefly, you just said that you had met, I think you had met Bailey.
Yeah, Ralph Bailey was on a busman's holiday up in Canada that summer, the summer before I left. And had called up one day and wanted to know if he could have a tour. And I didn't know Ralph, had never heard of him. He had spent all of his life in the coal business. But anyhow, I said, sure, when would you like to come? And he said, well, how about Sunday? So we spent a Sunday together. And he and a fellow that he had worked very closely with for years and years named Gene Samples. And so they came to the mine and we spent a very enjoyable day together. I showed them the whole lashup. And it was fun
the
doing
whole
it.
What?
The whole operation.
What was the word you said?
I said lashup.
Lashup.
Yeah,
okay.
But the whole operation.
Oh, that's lashup is fine. I just wanted to be sure.
And we.
That must be a Canadian expression.
Well, I don't know where that comes
from. Dog sleds
from.
Or something?
Yeah.
Anyway, excuse me for interrupting you.
So we had a really enjoyable day together, talking about all of the things that we had done. And Ralph was a vice president of Consolidation Coal Company, and Gene was his chief engineer. And they had a open pit coal mine over in Alberta, just across the border, still in the Rockies. It was Luskar, the Luskar coal mine. And they had been very successful with that, made a lot of money operating that. So they'd heard a lot about what we were doing over across the ridge and just wanted to see it. They had been up visiting their Luskar mine and wanted to see what we were doing. So at any rate, we spent a great day together, and as so happens so often in life, you just sort of hit it off with people. Then you really can't account for it. You just do. And so Ralph was a guy that he and I just sort of hit it off from that first day. And so when he left, he said, "If you're ever looking for a job, give me a call." And so I said, "Okay."
Okay.
So anyway, forgot that was summertime. Forgot about that, and then by this time, I was deciding that I really didn't have any future there in Fernie any longer, and I needed to be getting on to my next opportunity, wherever it was. So that fall, I think I was given a paper at one of the mining congress meetings. So it was here in San Francisco, and so I was down for that, and Ralph Bailey was there. And so I called him before we went to San Francisco, and I said, "Are you going to be in San Francisco?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "So am I. How about having lunch?" And he said, "Yeah, I'd like to." So we did. And so I told him, "Well, you told me before, if I was ever looking for a job, to get in touch with you." And I said, "I'm thinking of leaving Canada." So I said, "Well, let me think about that and see what we have." So that was all of that for a month or so. And then he called back and said, "Yeah," he said, "I'd like you to come back to Ohio, to our division there, and we'll make you general superintendent of mines. But that's just sort of a temporary thing, and sort of adjusting some people." He had just taken his job, his more senior job with Consolidation Coal Company at that point, so he was sort of reorganizing things and sort of lining up a crew.
Was he president?
No, he was not president. He was a vice president, of the company. Mm-hmm. And that company, Consolidation Coal Company, was a subsidiary of Conoco, the gas, the oil and gas company, mm-hmm. Continental Oil Company, Conoco. And at any rate, he said, "We can give you this job there right now, and then I'm sort of reorganizing stuff, and there'll probably be something else within a little while." Didn't say exactly how long. So he said, what do you need for a salary?" And I said, "Well, guy hates to take a cut in pay." He says, "Well, you don't have to. We'll pay you whatever you get." And so that was very fair. And so anyhow, we moved to Ohio, to St. Clairsville, Ohio. And this was the Ohio division of Consolidation Coal Company. And they must have had, you know, six or seven mines in that division, probably producing 5 or 6 million tons a year, something like that, of coal, all steam coal, no metallurgical coal. So anyhow, went back there. We bought a house, fixed it up. Phyllis did, and we got it all ready. And then she was spending most of her time back in Canada because Red was still in Canada going to school. And so I was there only maybe 6 months. Yeah, January, not even 6 months, about 5 months, 4 months, 4 or 5 months. And then we were transferred to Southern Illinois, to the Midwestern Division. And I was then made vice president and general manager of that division.
What was the town in Illinois?
We lived in Carbondale.
Carbondale.
Yeah. And so we lived there, I guess, for about 2.5 years. Yeah, 2.5 years. And then that division, we had six surface mines, and we were developing a new surface mine and had one underground mine in that division. And we must have been producing 5 to 7 million tons of coal a year, something like that.
All in that same general area of Southern Illinois?
Illinois. We had one mine up near Peoria, and then the underground mine was in mid-state, and then the other surface mines are in the southern part of the state. Mm-hmm. And so we were there for about 2.5 years, and
were you using the same kind of equipment that you used
well,
before?
No, not really. This was flat country, so we were using drag lines successfully, and we had a couple of shovels that operated much like drag lines. In other words, they would take the rock off of the coal seam and just swing around and dump it where the coal had been put, had been mined out, and left a foot wall that was clean of coal. And so it would swing around and dump there and just keep advancing along and make another cut. And you'd follow the cut with trucks and a front end loader and pick the coal up and take it out. And then when he came back to make the next cut, put the spoil rock in that void spot. So
is this what people call strip mining?
That's strip mining.
Okay.
And you know, one of the things that our industry has had difficulty informing the lay public about is the difference between strip mining and open pit mining.
Mm-hmm.
And in the West, even coal mining, there's very little strip mining because the coal seams aren't flat. They're pitching at some angle to a vertical, or to pitching it to a horizontal. But the difference that the public has trouble understanding is they say, well, if the coal miners back east and in the Midwest can move along laterally, mining the coal and just putting the spoil right back where they left it, you don't leave a pit when it's all over. But out here in the West, you leave these pits. And of course, the difference is our metallic ore bodies go to depth. They aren't tabular and horizontal, paralleling the surface. So you can't just transfer the waste back to where you've just taken the ore out of, because the ore continues to go to depth. And so that's been something that we've had difficulty informing the lay public about, the difference between open pit mining and strip mining.
It's my feeling that for some reason strip mining has a horrible connotation with most people who don't know anything about mining.
It does. And
it's just become a generic word for
bad
things to do.
And these terms get mixed up. There's strip mining and there's contour mining. There's a difference between those two. Back in the Appalachian Mountains, which are rather heavily eroded mountains that are quite benign, really. They're hills more than mountains, as we'd call them out here. The coal seams outcrop a lot because of the erosion patterns. And so a practice back there is to just go along these outcrops and just keep cutting back into the hillside as far as you can till it finally gets so deep it's not economic anymore. And so they leave these contours around these hilltops, these mountain ridges, and just, you know, here's the spoil over the side and here's this big cut, and a lot of that coal has high sulfur, so it oxidizes and makes sulfuric acid and, you know, all of the bad stuff associated with that in the streams. So that's contour mining. And then in the Midwest and out on the prairies, where there's strip mining, i.e. the ground surface and the coal bed are parallel, and the coal is close enough to the surface that you can strip the rock off. That just moves laterally, and that is really relatively simple to reclaim. You can just take dozers and flatten that off again. And now the states all have regulations that you take the topsoil off, set it aside, then mine, then flatten it, then put the topsoil back on, and you've got these beautiful fields that are again available for farming and so forth. So that's the ideal situation for mining. If all surface mining could be that simple, we'd have a lot less problems.
Mm-hmm.
But in the old days, they didn't do that.
They just left it.
Yeah, and the market said, we're not going to pay you for doing that,
mm-hmm.
i.e., we're not going to give you that much more in our electricity rates to pay for the coal that paid for that reclamation. So markets would pay for it. People would have been happy to do it because they probably could have made a little money doing that too.
Yeah.
But nobody's paying for it. So, and interestingly enough, back in the Midwest and the East, today's ratepayers are paying for that. Every ton of coal is mined, a piece of it goes into reclamation to go back and reclaim lands that nobody claims anymore.
Mm.
You know, it wasn't us that did it.
Wow.
So they're going back and reclaiming a lot of that land, and today's ratepayers are paying for it. And so, you know, we're sort of working with that same issue now out here in the West on all of these small mines that are all over the Rocky Mountain West that are unclaimed. Nobody knows how they got there, and they don't belong to anybody. How are we gonna cover up those shafts and these other exposures that are dangerous or polluting waters? Who's gonna pay for that? And so we're debating that right now, because it's a lot different than in the East, where you have this coal mining activity and people in their rates really not even knowing they're paying to have this ground remediated. That isn't the case out here in the West, and so that's an issue that the Mining Association, the National Mining Association, is working with Congress now on ways to solve that.
At this point, this is
73 to 75.
This is just the beginning of the environmental
era.
I think 1970 was the Environmental Protection Act, wasn't it?
Yes, and the first Earth Day was like 1971 or no, 73. I think the first Earth Day was 73. So you're right. That was just when that was all getting started.
Were you aware of it at that time in Illinois?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Became aware of it there. We up in Canada, they were right up to the U.S. on all of that at that time, and we had a lot of it, environmental compliance to be not only aware of, but to comply with. There were regulations that governed our water discharges and how to keep sediment from getting into the streams from our dumps and so forth. We were required to build dams to impound waters to let the sediment drop out,
even then,
in 70. So Canada, particularly British Columbia, because it was provincial, those regulations were provincial, was every bit as advanced as the U.S. on that, perhaps even more so.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, by the time I got to the Midwest with Consolidation Coal Company, I was none of that was a surprise
mm-hmm.
to me, and I was just. That was the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that.
Now, did you have to move? You mentioned that Red finished high school in British Columbia.
British Columbia.
And then he came down to the States to college.
Yes, he while he was up there in that that last spring semester, he came down and took his SAT tests and then enrolled at Colorado School of Mines that following fall. And so he went right off to college.
He didn't move to Illinois then?
No.
Well, kind of.
And he worked two summers at one of the mines there.
Did Press finish school up in BC then too?
No, he didn't. He then joined us in Illinois, and but he graduated here, and he did his half of his junior year and his senior year here in California, where we live now, and graduated from high school there. And then he went to junior college for, a year or so, but Press never really cared about studies, and so he went to work at a mine up in Idaho, in southern Idaho, in the Owyhee Mountains. I'm trying to remember the name. It was a silver-gold property.
In what mountains?
The Owyhee Mountains in south western Idaho.
Which one was the painter? I remember.
It was Wren, the oldest boy. And he did that. He did all of his painting when he was, must have been in the eighth or ninth grade.
I remember you had some nice paintings on
your
walls.
Yeah, he was really very, very talented at that. And that was when we were at Eagle Mountain. And he had an art teacher that was just very good, and they encouraged him to do that, and it turns out he had a talent for it. He even went, USC used to have a summer campus up above Palm Springs in Hemet, just above Hemet, and Red got a scholarship one summer to go up there for 4 weeks or something like that, and take art course. And so Phyllis and I said, well, we can't let this little guy go up to a camp by himself with college kids. At any rate, he really was good, but he hadn't touched, he hasn't touched a brush since, so that was short-lived. But anyhow, we have those wonderful paintings that he did in our home. So that was fun.
So you were in Carbondale then.
Carbondale for a little over two years, yeah. And then the reason for leaving there was one of opportunity, I guess. Consolidation Coal Company was, and by this time Ralph Bailey had become president of the company. Again, it's still a subsidiary of Conoco. He decided to, we needed to further consolidate this company into fewer regions, or there were divisions. I think there were 9 divisions for the different regions. So he was going to consolidate that into 5 regions from 9. And so the plan was, and this was just unfolding at the same time I was contacted about Homestake. And that must have been, sort of like summertime, which would have been in 74, late 70, probably wasn't summertime, maybe it's fall of 74. Contacted by Homestake. And well, it's more like 75, early 75. The plan, Ralph Bailey's plan was to consolidate the company into 5 operating regions. And one was in the west, one was in Indianapolis, and the other 3 were in the Appalachians. And so the plan was, I was going to go to Indianapolis to run that region, which would have probably been 15 coal mines or something like that. And so then the next move would have been to Pittsburgh, which is where the company's headquarters were. If there was to be a next move, that's where it would be. Well, I used to go back to Pittsburgh for the meetings and all that stuff, so I knew, got to know Pittsburgh pretty well. And it wasn't on the top of my list of places to live. And Phyllis and I were both from the West Coast, so you know we really did miss being out here in the West. And so the homestake opportunity came up at the same time.
Who contacted you?
Well, I was contacted by Frank Schwab, who had done this work for Paul. And I didn't know Frank, nor he, I, except he knew more about me than I thought. But anyhow, I was at one of the mining meetings, probably the Mining Congress meeting, and Frank came up to me at a reception and introduced himself, said who he was, and he said...
No, you said he'd done this work for Paul. We've talked about that earlier, but what work are
you
talking about?
Paul had...
Paul Henshaw.
Paul Henshaw, the president and CEO of Homestake, had been thinking of... how the company was going to develop, and thinking of it in the context that for the last 7 or 8 years, maybe 10 years, the company had really had a difficult time because of the various markets it was in, not the least of which is the gold market, where the government had controlled the price of gold artificially for all these years, and it was very difficult for the company to make money in its main gold operation at the Homestake mine in the Black Hills, South Dakota. And so...
I'm trying to think, when did Nixon release the prize, or maybe that's not the word?
No, but he unpegged it. And
that
was about 68. What he did was shut the gold window. Because all of the Europeans kept repatriating all of their paper money for gold, and our gold reserves were going out the window, just lickety-split. And so he shut the gold window and said, we're not going to redeem our paper for gold anymore. But that was in the late 60s. But still, the gold price hadn't moved that much, even though that happened. But that started... to unpeg it from $35, so there was a dual market for gold, but in the U.S. it was still $35. So at any rate, because Homestake had been through these lean years, it had been a very efficient, modest company with. Very little income, and that income was coming mostly from uranium mining, which too had changed because in 1968 the government quit buying uranium, and so the company had to find commercial sales for its uranium, a whole new business. But at the end of the 60s and in the early 70s, all of a sudden Homestake started making good money in uranium because they had good contracts and good costs. And the lead zinc operation at Buick started to really become very profitable for Homestake. And all of a sudden, the company was making quite a bit of money. And now, here's a company that had really been backed up to the wall, so to speak, financially all these years because of the circumstances I mentioned.
And now it was starting to make a lot of money. And what were we going to do with the money? So some of the directors, and I think Bernd Shepman as one, was very outspoken on this, recommended that Paul engage some firm to help he and the management team think about what the company was going to look like going forward, because this money was coming in and they needed to know what kind of investments to make to best utilize these earnings and cash flow. And so Paul engaged Frank Schwab, who was a consultant that did this kind of work. So Frank worked with Paul and the management group and came up with a strategy for Homestake going forward to invest its money. And so that's how Frank got involved in this. Then a second part, and this happens in most cases, now that you have this plan, you also need to staff it. And in looking at your people, we think that you need some new blood here in this activity and new blood in that activity. And we can help you do that too, which is always good to have business development. And so that was the second part of that, which involved me then. Frank coming up to me at this meeting and saying, introduced himself, and we chatted for a few minutes. And he said that he had heard of me, and is it true that I had worked in copper and in iron ore, and he knew I was working in coal because I was with Consolidation Coal Company then. And I know you've been in coal. He said, are all these things true? And I said, yeah, I've done that. And he said, well, you know, that's unusual. Not too many people work in that many different parts of the mining business. And I said, yeah. I guess so. So, you know, just sort of a nice conversation. And that was the end of that as far as I was concerned. But then it was just a week or two later that he called me up and said, you know, I've got a situation that I'm working on that you might just be the kind of person they're looking for. And so I said, yeah, what's that? So he described this new organization that he had suggested to Paul.
Just a second.